Okay, at the end of side one, Andy, we were talking about the congregation.
The Jewish community.
Yeah.
It was a very active Jewish community. I really don't... I'm trying to guess. Maybe there were 50 families, perhaps, that were involved in the congregation. But it was an active Jewish community. They had a club that they formed. They had masquerade parties, which were popular then, and put on skits, and had recitals, music recitals and everything. My great-grandmother was a very accomplished pianist, and had a nice voice, and so she was often called upon to play and sing at these affairs.
So it was also...
Minna.
Did your grandfather, do you know if he had a bar mitzvah?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Because that would be in records, I would assume, if he did.
Well, I haven't been able to find any records.
Oh, because of the...
Yeah, there's no... The congregation doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And nobody seemed to know what happened to their records. But he graduated from high school at age 16. And Ida Tarbell, who is a well-known author, wrote for McClure's magazine exposés of Standard Oil Company, and she wrote a book later on about Standard Oil, and wrote a book on Abraham Lincoln. And, she and my grandfather, as children, were very good friends because they were both sort of loners.
And was she a contemporary of his, age-wise? Ida Tarbell was his contemporary as far as age?
Oh, they were classmates.
They were
in
classmates.
High school.
Isn't
oh, they were classmates in high school, and they were the two smartest in their class. And
isn't that
they were both involved in the commencement exercises, and I have a newspaper article that talks about the speech my grandfather gave. He was a commencement speaker for his class, and his subject of his commencement speech was to succeed, you must work hard. That was a theme, not the subject, that was a theme. You had to work hard to achieve success. And Ida had to play the piano. And they maintained their friendship throughout their life. When she came to Pittsburgh, she would visit and stay with my grandparents. Then, for a year, my grandfather worked in their bottling plant. They felt he was too young to go to college. And in 1876, my grandfather left Titusville for the University of Virginia, where he matriculated. There again, he was faced with a lot of obstacles. His class had 347 students. 179 were from Virginia. There were only 17 Northerners, and which included my father, my grandfather. The majority who went to the University of Virginia at that time were Episcopalian. I won't go into the Virginia. For a long time, that was the only religion that was permitted. It was back in the early days of Virginia. They ran Baptists out of town. I mean, when they tried to teach other religions back in the early days of Virginia.
Yes, but your great-grandparents were Jewish, and you said they were comfortable.
Well, I'm talking about earlier.
Oh, earlier, I see.
Very
okay.
Early on.
Before it was part of the United States?
Oh, yes, sure. Okay. Very often.
But it was a colony or whatever.
The early colonial days, yes. But then the Presbyterians, Methodists, and others came in, and in my grandfather's class, there were no other Jews, and only very, very few Catholics, mostly all Episcopalians, Presbyterians, then some Methodists and Baptists. In fact, he wasn't sure, but he may have been the only Jew in the whole university at that time. And there again, of course, being now from the north, still being, you know, small for his, among his classmates, and being of the Jewish religion, he had a tough time. Mm-hmm. But he was a very good debater. He joined a debating club and became one of the better debaters in the school. And in 1879, at the age of 21, he graduated with a law degree and came back north to practice law. In 1879, then he was admitted to the bar of both Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and started out, he was hired by a law firm named Hutchins and Campbell from Cleveland, but he I think he was unhappy with the limitations of the type of practice. It was a bigger law firm, I suppose, and like today, you have structure, and he felt he'd be happier on his own. So in 1882, he became a partner with R. Barrett Stone, who was publisher of the Bradford Evening Star, and they formed a firm, Stone and Weil, in Bradford, just the two of them.
Now, how far is Bradford from Titusville?
Perhaps 75 or 100 miles at the most.
I see.
Bradford is further, it's almost on the New York State boundary line. It's probably the coldest place in the eastern part of
the
United States.
Yeah.
Terrible weather there. Yeah. Just horrible. He married, in 1883, he married Cassie, C-A-S-S-I-E, Ritter, R-I-T-T-E-R, my grandmother, yeah, who is the daughter of Ferdinand Ritter, who was a very prominent, successful Jewish Youngstown, Ohio merchant. He had owned a store there. And my grandfather was fortunate enough to, his sister, Hannah, introduced him to Cassie, and they fell in love. In 1883, they got married. And in 1886, my grandfather moved to Pittsburgh. By then, he'd become a very successful oil and gas lawyer. In Bradford, it was that whole area, northern Pennsylvania, was oil and gas. And a lot of people had moved from Titusville, moved to Bradford. Bradford became a bigger town than Titusville was at even its largest size. I think Bradford, by then, it probably had 25,000 people. So he, my grandfather, had a very keen mind. He was very resolute, aggressive, energetic, tireless worker, and built up a very good reputation and became expert in oil and gas and attracted a lot of producers and refiners. And then, as those producers and gassers, Pittsburgh became a very large oil refining center. And a lot of the families moved to Pittsburgh and persuaded my grandfather to come and bring his office and set up an office in Pittsburgh. One of the largest oil and gas producers in Western Pennsylvania was a man named Jennings, who my grandfather represented. And he moved to Pittsburgh. He was a very wealthy man. His name was Frank Jennings.
With two N's?
J-E-N-N-I-N-G-S. And he has a great grandson named Evan D. Jennings here in Pittsburgh, who's a very close friend of mine, and he's been a very close friend of mine for quite a few years, and also a client, which makes it quite interesting, the circle. Mm-hmm. And so my grandfather set up an office here. They rented a three-story house on Marchand Street, M-A-R-C-H-A-N-D.
Where's that?
Which is between Shadyside and East Liberty. It's near, not far from Shady Avenue. It's before you come to East Liberty. Then in 1895, my grandfather formed a partnership with Charles M. Thorpe. It became Weil and Thorpe. Thorpe was a corporate attorney, he was a part of a Blue Book, Pittsburgh family, had a corporate practice, but hated litigation, and my grandfather, by then, had become quite a successful and able litigator. So it was a natural thing for them to form a partnership. That, it was Weil and Thorpe till 1922, I believe, when my grandfather and Mr. Thorpe split off. The Thorpe firm continued on. It became Thorpe, Reed, and Armstrong. They're now in the National Steel Building, and they're celebrating their 100th anniversary, and they have in the lobby of their firm's office, they've got a picture of my grandfather and Mr. Thorpe as the founding members of the firm, and descriptions under them about their careers and so forth.
This is currently?
It's going on right now. It's still up there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's up there. It'll be up there all year, I suppose. And I've seen it. It's a very nice display. They had an office on 4th Avenue across from the, right across from the courthouse, which was completed in 1888. The one we have there today was built in 1888. And it was in the St. Nicholas Building, which has been torn down. It no longer exists. My grandfather became, in a short number of years, and the firm prospered, became one of the prestigious firms in town. They were counsel for Manufacturers Light and Heat, at that time, the forerunner of Duquesne Light and so forth. They had a number of banks that were their clients, three or four steel companies, which are now part of U.S. Steel. Rosenbaum's, Frank and Cedar, Boggs and Buell apartment stores, which no longer exist, and the William Penn and Fort Pitt hotels. So they have many prominent businesses and manufacturing plants. My grandfather then became probably one of the most prominent trial lawyers in the state of Pennsylvania. I was able to, through our computer at our office, have a complete list of every case that he had argued before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and the Circuit Court of Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court. And I found 104 cases that he'd argued before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, an average of about five a year, 25 before the Circuit Court of Appeals, and 14 cases that he actually argued in the U.S. Supreme Court. Many of them were what we call cases of first impression. In other words, a case that established new law where there'd been no decision on that subject before. His most famous case, I think, he was hired by the state of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. I mean, the case was the state of Pennsylvania versus and Ohio versus West Virginia. West Virginia passed a statute saying that if gas was in short supply, the gas producers had to satisfy customers in West Virginia before they could ship gas into Pennsylvania and Ohio, so that during a period of shortage, customers in Pennsylvania and businesses would be shut off from gas. My grandfather filed the lawsuit directly in the U.S. Supreme Court as an injunction against the state of West Virginia, and was successful. The Supreme Court agreed with my grandfather's position that that was a violation of interstate commerce, and they could not do that under the Constitution. So they, my grandfather, had a saying that his battle cry was "No favors asked, none granted" in his lawsuits. He was a very aggressive litigator, but he was always a gentleman. He fought hard, but he was always a gentleman, and he was scrupulously honest. He had one case. It was a case in which involved a bankruptcy, and he was asked to take a position that would have, in his opinion, felt it would be a violation of one of the rules of the U.S. District Court and would be unethical. And so he turned down a fee of, at that time was $38,000. Which was, in today's money, $570,000, because he thought it would have been improper.
What year was that?
And that was in,
just to get some idea.
About 1915, perhaps. And it also meant that an attorney in New York would have lost part of that fee, and he filed a suit against my grandfather, and that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court censored the attorney from New York and wrote a scathing rebuke in their opinion. And he was a prominent New York attorney, and he asked the Supreme Court to delete the offensive language that they used, and they refused to do so. In 1898, my grandfather built a house on Howe Street at the corner of Highland Avenue. It was a 2.5-story yellow brick house with a carriage house, 5931 Howe Street. It's still there. It's been remodeled into condominiums, but the house still is there today. In 1899, Frick and Carnegie got into a fight, and Frick sued Carnegie, and my grandfather was just very briefly involved. He advised Carnegie. Carnegie asked him whether what he should do, and my grandfather told him he better settle the case. He couldn't stand it. Carnegie couldn't stand the publicity that would have existed if the facts and everything had been made public.
Do you know what the fight was about?
The fight, oh yes. But it's been written, the fight between Frick and Carnegie has been written about many times, and it would take too much time to explain all the details, but it was a very highly publicized fight, and but it was settled. And shortly after that, within 2 years, Carnegie sold his interest out to J.P. Morgan, and Morgan formed U.S. Steel Corporation out of Carnegie Steel, that had been the major source. And at the same time, they bought up, U.S. Steel was formed out of maybe two dozen smaller steel companies, of which four or five were represented by my grandfather. So he was involved indirectly in the formation of the U.S. Steel by reason of the fact that he had to prepare a lot of agreements of sale for all the companies that were bought up. So then, shortly after that, I should go into a little bit about the political situation in Pittsburgh at the turn of the century.
Okay, you were going to talk about the political situation. Yes, now, what year is this?
Between 1840 and 1911, Pittsburgh had a bicameral legislature comprised of a select and common council. In 1900, the select council had two councilmen from each ward. They had 45 wards, so they had 90 councilmen. The common council had 30, who were from the wards according to population. So if you can imagine 120 politicians agreeing on any kind of legislation, that's when log rolling became very popular.
Can you explain that for us?
Log rolling is an expression that came from woodsmen who, when they cut their logs, for example, up in northern Pennsylvania, they cut a lot of timber. And when they cut the timber, they would roll the logs down the hillside into a river and collect several hundred logs in the river, and they would be temporarily sort of dammed up in a part of the river that wasn't swift flowing. And then to get them downstream where there'd be logging mills, a group of these loggers would get on a log and get several logs rolling, and as the logs would roll, others would roll, and pretty soon one log would roll, bump another, and all the logs eventually would get rolling. And that's what happened in these large legislatures. One legislature would say, well, here's something I'd like to have passed, and if you'll pass that, I'll vote for something you want. So they would all agree to support each other for legislation. So, unfortunately, much of the legislation was bought. At the turn of the century, street railways started to become formed.
Is that like the interurban?
No, the streetcars.
Okay.
Right? But there wasn't one company. There were maybe a half a dozen that got franchises for each street. Every street maybe had a franchise. Not quite so bad, but they would buy them. The council would give Company A a franchise to run a streetcar from, say, Oakland to downtown. They would pay the councilman money. It wouldn't go to the city. The money would go to the councilman to grant them the franchise. And they had franchises for building waterworks, for electrical things. Whatever anybody wanted, they would pay. There'd be a bagman from the council. And, of course, the city was suffering. Instead of the money going into the city, it would end up in the pockets of crooked councilmen. If a company wanted a street closed, they'd go to their representative and say they want to expand their building and close the street. Things that were going on. There was a prominent contracting firm called Booth and Flynn, at the time, at that time in Pittsburgh at the turn of the century. And they paved most of the city's streets. We call them cobblestones. They were actually paving blocks made out of granite from Ligonier. They're called Ligonier blocks. The Booth and Flynn, for example, in one year was awarded $3,517,000 in contracts, and all the other firms that were bidding against it got $33,000. And the specifications were written in such a way as only Booth and Flynn, who owned the source of this Ligonier block in Ligonier, could bid on the contracts. Others would underbid them, but they didn't have maybe the right color or the right this or that, and so they didn't get contracts. The banks, in order to become city depository, would pay a bribe. Certain banks, not all of them, certain banks were out of something like 30 banks in Pittsburgh at that time. Maybe there were only four or five that paid bribes to get the city contracts. And so, here again, the bank would pay money to get a contract, and the contract would go to these crooked councilmen. The city would get no benefit and would actually lose because the banks were awarded contracts at a lower rate of interest than other banks would have paid the city who weren't paying bribes. And the city was, there was Christopher McGee was the Republican Party at that time, from the Civil War on until probably the late 1915, for say 50 years, ran Pittsburgh and other northern cities. The Republican Party was in control. And being in control over such a long period of time gave tremendous power to the chairman of the Republican Party. Christopher McGee was the party boss, and he had what was referred to then as a ring. It was called the ring. There was a, in New York, they had, I think, the Boss Tweedy, and in Chicago, there are many cities had rings, politicians just ran everything. Lincoln Steffens, in 1903, wrote The Shame of the Cities in McClure's magazine, and he had picked, I think, four cities. Pittsburgh was one of the cities that one of these articles was written about, and it was called The Shame of Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh was probably the worst of most of the cities as far as crooked politicians, vice, and everything else involved. In 1902, my grandfather and H.W. English, Starling Childs, and George R. Wallace formed the Voters League of Allegheny County.
Okay, let's stop right there.